Today's episode of The Grave Talks is brought to you by HelloFresh. Go to HelloFresh.com/grave12 and use code GRAVE12 for 12 free meals, including free shipping. HelloFresh.com/grave12. Use code GRAVE12 for 12 free meals, including free shipping. Today on The Grave Talks, Pragmatic Paranormal, a conversation with Alex Matsuo. Quite often we hear about paranormal investigators and their extreme sensory abilities. This is not one of those stories. This is a story of a paranormal investigator who comes into investigations with a very pragmatic and empathetic approach, but takes the emotion out of the mix. How does this help or hinder her investigations and experiences? Today, we discuss all of this and more with Alex Matsuo on The Grave Talks.
Let's see. I mean, I've kind of always had an interest in it, even from the time I was like a little kid. Mm-hmm. It was always something I wanted to watch on TV. If there was anything in the store that was like creepy, I was reaching for it. But I did have an experience when I was a kid, and I was about anywhere between like seven to nine years old. And it was in Kentucky. I was visiting my great grandmother. I'm a California kid, so I don't really know, like, you know, I didn't know like Appalachian lore back then. I mean, we're talking like the boonies of Kentucky. And yeah, I mean, I had a really strange experience, and it did freak me out, but also at the same time after it happened, I was like, oh, that's cool. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to know more. But my mother really discouraged anything paranormal and the occult in the house. Like, it just wasn't allowed. So, but of course, when you tell that to a kid, they just want it more. So,
sure.
Yeah, that's kind of the short version of it. So it's been a crazy ride since then. I mean, the first part of my life, it was just a lot of sneaking around to maintain and cultivate the interest until I was old enough to drive and, you know, eventually go to college and move out and stuff.
How did that affect you as a kid, where you had that interest and somewhat of experiences, but the family around you is like, nope, we don't talk about that. We're not going to have this in the house. Did it discourage or did it make you want to know more?
It made me want to know more. I was looking up books at the library, but I wasn't checking out the books in the library, like, because I couldn't bring it home. The whole discouragement of anything spooky was so, like, intense that I couldn't even, like, read the Goosebumps books.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, watching Are You Afraid of the Dark was a no-go, even though I would watch it anyway, because my mom went to bed really early. So that was really, it just made me want to know more.
Mm-hmm. As you were wanting to know more, was it something that it was just kind of like, ooh, this is spooky and this is neat? Or was it more of a, this is spooky, this is neat, and I believe this stuff is real?
It was more of like, I wanted it to be real, and even today I want it to be real, but I don't know if it's real. So it's basically me just for years since I was a kid, just me wanting to get some validation for it.
Sure. Well, tell me, as things progressed, as you got older, you had a car, you could drive and kind of do things a little more independently. Where did that take you in terms of investigating or interests and kind of trying to dig more into it beyond the confines of your household, that really it was a no-go there?
Yeah, I mean, when I started learning how to drive, I was 16 years old. So my scope of spooky things was very limited, especially growing up in a major city where anything that's older than 15 years old is knocked down. Mm-hmm. So the only haunted place that I really knew about at the time was the Whaley House and Old Town San Diego. And so that's basically where I was going. I was going to the little cemetery down the street from the Whaley House and taking tours of the Whaley House when I could. And yeah, I mean, that was really just like the scope of it. And this was, I mean, this was like early 2000s. So Ghost Hunters was just starting to come out on TV. And so my scope was just super limited. And plus being 16 years old, I mean, it's not like I could get in a car and leave for an entire weekend, you know? Sure. So it was literally like, okay, my mom went to bed. I'm going to call up my friend. We're going to go to the Whaley house and see what happens.
So what did happen?
Not much. Not much at all. Which, if anything, it just kind of got me more interested in it. I went to this location probably every weekend for 2 years. So we're talking like hundreds of times. And then, of course, I left San Diego in my late 20s. And so, I mean, there's been a lot of visits there. And I mean, so far I've been able to debunk most of it. Okay. Because it's public. I mean, it's public property. It's, you know, Old Town San Diego is also a night spot. So a lot of noise. So a lot of the stuff was just debunkable.
Let's talk about that a little bit. Let's talk about the Whaley House itself and some of the legends that surround it. What were some of the things that you had heard growing up that you were trying to figure out, you know, is this real? And then let's talk about what some of the debunking showed you.
Yeah. There's been a lot.
So
there's a lot of like urban legends surrounding the Whaley House, like Yankee Jim, who was hung in the gallows on the land for stealing a rowboat, which back in, you know, 1800s, that was disastrous for a growing town. And so like reports that if you step on the 13th step going up to the second floor, you can feel a chill because that's where he died. Let's see. One of the Whaley daughters was playing tag outside the house and she ran into a clothesline and basically clotheslined herself and died. Mm-hmm. And yeah, those are probably the two more popular ones. And then, of course, there was the woman, you know, the woman in white could be seen inside the house. Let's see. I actually never got a chance to investigate the Whaley House. So all of my like adventures in the Whaley House were literally during public tours and just seeing what I could catch. And then, of course, just hanging out outside late at night, trying to contact one of the Whaley daughter that had died from being clotheslined. So, yeah.
So how have some of these stories been? Okay, back to our conversation in just a moment. First, I want to thank our supporter today, HelloFresh. I love HelloFresh. So many good things. I'll tell you what I've been cooking here in just a minute. But what is HelloFresh? With HelloFresh, you get fresh, pre-measured ingredients, mouth-watering seasonal recipes delivered right to your door. HelloFresh lets you skip those trips to the grocery store, which is nice. Makes home cooking easy, fun, affordable. That's why it's America's number one meal kit. I absolutely love these guys. And here's some of the reasons. Number one, it cuts out the meal planning. If you're someone who is pretty busy, like I am, and you're like, okay, I got to plan this, I got to plan that, this cuts all that out. It cuts it out because they have all the meal plans for you. You pick what looks good. And then boom, the food shows up to you. It's all pre-portioned. It's all there. There's no waste. You can enjoy cooking dinner at home, get it on the table in about 30 minutes or less. Plus, HelloFresh offers 10 to 20 minute meals too. So if you got a busy life going on and you're like, okay, I want to cook fresh at home. I don't want to do the drive-through, but we got to get this done so we can get to our next thing. It's wonderful. Low prep recipes, quick breakfast, lunches, perfect for a busy schedule. Okay. HelloFresh is something that I've now been using and enjoying for a couple of years now. Some of my favorite recipes, some recent ones that have been pretty high on the list of favorites in our house. The sesame beef tacos with quick pickled veggies and sriracha sour cream. Yes, my family enjoys spicy. Me and Harper always about that. How about this one? This is a great healthy one, and it's great for spring as we're getting into it. The orchard chicken salad, roasted sweet potatoes, apples, toasted pecans. Those are awesome. So many things to choose from, and you can't go wrong. You just dig into it, and you're like, oh my gosh, there is definitely something for me in virtually any sort of diet or thing that you're looking for. So check it out for yourself. HelloFresh. And get yourself this. Check this out. 12 free meals. How do you do it? Go to HelloFresh.com/grave12. Use code GRAVE12 for 12 free meals, including free shipping. Go to HelloFresh.com/GRAVE12. Use code GRAVE12 for 12 free meals, including free shipping. HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit. And debunked over the years of the Whaley House.
Well, I don't know, like, any official debunking stories, but a lot of it can be, like, the story of the woman in white. There's plexiglass at the entrance of every room of the Whaley House, pretty much, like, the bedrooms and all that stuff. I mean, there's a few rooms that don't have the plexiglass, but most of them do. And a lot of the pictures that had come out of the, like, the ghosts at the Whaley House were taken in front of that plexiglass. So that one is easily debunkable, as it's literally a reflection or a lens flare type of thing. So it's a reflection of light, or even just reflections of people that, you know, when people don't take note of their surroundings and they see a woman in the glass, they don't remember that a woman walked behind them at that moment the photo was taken. So when it comes to the chill on the 13th step, I personally have never felt anything weird going up to the second floor. The ones who have felt things before, The ones who have felt weird things going up those steps, they usually have abilities that I've noticed, like, or they're more sensitive, and I'm not sensitive at all. I don't have any gifts. I don't have any abilities. So I'm very much a brick wall when it comes to that. I mean, if you put, like, a green ball in my hand and ask me to guess the color, I'm going to say purple. So, so I don't know if that has necessarily been debunked. I think it's just more of people who are a little bit more sensitive to the paranormal can feel it. So, and then when it comes to the haunting of the Whaley daughter being clotheslined, A lot of that report is, like, feeling oppressed and had that heavy feeling and whatnot. And for me, when I was younger going to that spot, I definitely felt freaked out about it. But I think it was because I was more freaked out by the story and letting that influence my experience. Because in my later years, when I had my own team, well, I still have my own team, but I was just starting my team back then, but really taking on, like, a skeptical believer perspective and trying to look at things objectively and basically just start turning off my emotions with it. And that's something I've kind of been doing ever since. I noticed that I didn't feel that feeling anymore. So meanwhile, if I told someone the story and then took them over there, they would have that feeling, as opposed to if I brought in a out of town friend who doesn't know the story and just said, oh, yeah, we're hanging out over here. You know, let's be, like, it'd be after, like, we go get food and we're just relaxing and chatting after. They wouldn't feel anything. So I think a lot of the stories surrounding the Whaley House are more of influence just by urban legend. And that's not to say that it's not haunted. I just don't know if the experiences that people have had are tied to that haunting.
Or more so just tied to being in an atmosphere that kind of produces that feeling because of what it is.
I mean, and the Whaley House is noted as being one of the most haunted houses in the world. I mean, it's, like, official. So, yeah, so I, and, but for me, I've just never had, like, a major, well, no, I did have one big experience there. That I probably I forgot to mention. This wasn't until I was, I think I was in college at the time. But again, it could be debunkable, but their docents and their employees are dressed in period clothing. And I was sitting outside the porch. I was getting ready for one of their tours. It was like a day tour. And this woman came up to me and she said, oh, is this your first time at the house? And I'm just chatting with her. And I'm like, no, you know, I live in San Diego. I grew up here. So the Whaley House has been, you know, part of life since I was, you know, a kid. And she was just saying, like, how excited she was for me to come see the house and all this stuff. And then, and I mean, the patterns of her dress, the color of her hair were very distinct. Her garb looked a little different from the rest of the employees, because their dresses seemed a little crisper and cleaner, or looked more they look like they were manufactured recently. Mm-hmm. And this woman's dress wasn't. And I kept thinking, like, man, who is her seamstress? Because that's a really good job. And then I looked over and she was gone, and I'm like, okay, she must have walked off. And I don't know, she just kind of stuck out to me. And then when one of the docents was leading the tour, I kept looking around for this woman, and I actually asked, I said, hey, you know, where's the woman in the plaid dress with the browns and the reds, and her hair was like really nicely curled. And the docent looked at me and she's like, yeah, no one fitting that description works here, but you saw Mrs. Whaley most likely. And I'm like, oh, okay.
And was it delivered to you just like that, of just, yeah, you saw her? Because they've heard that so many times.
Yeah. She's a very, I can't remember her first name to save my life, but she's been reported around the area quite frequently. And even when, and I will say, the way she was talking to me seemed a bit odd too. I mean, because usually when docents or employees, you know, come and chat with the guests, it's more of like, oh, you know, did you know this house in this year, you know, was a courthouse, and you know, all these, they'll tell you like nitty-gritty details about the location, not just, oh, I'm so excited for you to see the house, or I'm so excited for you to see my house. Mm-hmm. So that was something worth noting. And that one, it might be debunkable, because some people have said, oh, they were just messing with you. But I mean, when you go to a place so often, you become familiar with all the faces there. You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah. Then it stands out to you if something is new or someone is new.
Yeah. And if she had been a plant, I would have seen her again. You know what I mean? And I never saw her again.
That's very interesting. Let me ask this, because you said earlier in the conversation that you're not a sensitive person. On, you know, a scale of 1 to 10, you're at the bottom of it. I get it. I'm kind of like that, too. Is being non-sensitive to you a pro or a con in paranormal investigating?
For me, personally, I think it's a pro, because at least, I guess it depends on what one's reasoning is for being involved in the paranormal. For me, sorry, my stomach just gurgled. I don't know if that was picked up by the mic.
I didn't hear it.
Oh, no. I'll try that again.
It was not an EVP, so we're good.
Oh, man. I had weight loss surgery in July, and now everything I eat or drink speaks loudly. It's annoying. So, yeah, I guess it just depends on what's one's motivation is for being in the field. Because I've noticed that, I don't know how many categories I could separate this out in, but I've noticed that there are the experiencers, like the ones who just want to have that experience. And I've noticed a lot of experiencers don't carry a lot of equipment with them, which I find interesting. Mm-hmm. And then you have the folks who are trying to find some sort of proof of the afterlife, or they're approaching it from a more scientific perspective. And yes, they will have the equipment and whatnot. I'm kind of in the middle there, because I do have equipment, and I do want to have that experience, but I also want to be able to assess and judge, like, okay, what was this? So, I've noticed a lot of my team members, my friends who do have abilities, when they go into a location, a lot of them seem to get really emotionally invested, which is understandable because, you know, they're sensitive and they can pick up on things that I can't. Sometimes, though, I do notice they kind of emotionally get out of control sometimes, or they get too looped into a certain feeling or a certain story, and then they just kind of fixate on that. And I find that it influences the rest of their experience in a location, mm-hmm. to the point where I've had to redirect. And especially if they do a reading and then it ends up being grossly inaccurate to the history of the location and whatnot. For example, when we were at Old South Pittsburgh Hospital, one of the rooms there was haunted. I don't remember her name. I'm just going to use a super generic name. Let's say her name was like Rosa Marie, mm-hmm. just one woman, Rosa Marie. And then my psychic gets in there and fixates on Rosa Marie and gets really wrapped up in Rosa Marie's story and all of these things. Meanwhile, I'm thinking in my head, we did the research on this location. Rosa Marie is not a real person. Mm-hmm. So then it takes like some, and actually we found out that Rosa Marie was actually two people. There okay. was a Rosa and a Marie.
Yeah.
So I find that a lot of times with, you know, the psychics that I work with, like the really good ones are able to remove themselves emotionally from it and just be able to objectively assess what they are picking up. Mm-hmm. It's tough. Like for me, I like not having abilities because I'm able to not just keep myself in check, but I can also keep my team in check, if that makes sense.
Sure. With you not having the abilities, though, you're relying on another to, you know, basically give you that information through what they're feeling mm-hmm. and what they're sensing. Do you ever have situations where you have the sensitive or the psychic that's very on one location and you're thinking, wow, that's amazing, because now that we cross-reference this, everything they talked about checks out. And you take them to another location and it's literally, you know, Rosa Marie doesn't exist. That sort of thing where nothing, yep. nothing checks out. And how do you explain something like that when that happens?
Yeah, I've actually experienced that several times with my psychic mediums. And I always try to remind them that you're not going to be correct 100% of the time. I like to compare it to just our general social life and what we are drawn to and what we pick up on. Like for me, I love theater. I gravitate to theater people and people who are more creative and whatnot. Meanwhile, oh, my cat's meowing. Hang on. Let me get her out of the room.
Special effects.
Right? Oh, baby girl. I forgot she was in the room. I'm sorry.
It's fine. No, we have pets in here all the time. So it's fine.
So I find myself, I'm drawn to more like creative people, and that's like my circle of friends. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, my boyfriend loves wrestling. He's like watching anime. I like anime too, but we like a very different style of anime. But he has completely different interests than me. So if I go to a wrestling event, he's going to sync up much more with that crowd and that environment than I am. Whereas when we go to the theater, not right now because of COVID, but yeah. when we go to the theater, I'm in my element and he's there to support. So I think that goes I think that's the same for psychic mediums. I think it just depends on whether they sync up with that location or there's a spirit there that's drawn to them, like they sync up personality-wise, or there's a common interest there that draws them to each other. So I think there is something to that. And plus, there's so many different branches of abilities. Like, oh my gosh, if you look at the umbrella, it's like, yeah. you know, clairsentient, clairvoyance. I can't even remember the rest, but there's a lot. So I think it just really depends if you sync up with that location or not. Now, if I have a person who says they're a medium and they're just hit and misses, like one after another, after another, after another, then I may be sitting there like, you sure? You sure you got abilities? You certain?
Or did somebody just tell you that a lot and you believe it? Yeah. No, it's interesting. What's your take on, because many people who have abilities, and some say that they developed them further into life and they didn't have it. It wasn't necessarily a childhood gift that they knew they always had, but they fully believe that almost anyone can develop these things if they're honed in upon enough. From someone who is out there in the field as yourself, and I'm sure you've heard that before as well, what's your take on that? Do you think that you could ever develop something by learning it? I mean, specifically an ability in terms of sensitivity, or is it something that you would say, look, it's either here or it's not. I don't know how I'm going to pick this one up by learning more about how you're doing it.
That's a great question. I think I struggle with this because I have tried to tune into something.
Sure.
I have tried to develop a gift, and I tried for about a year, and it was one of those I just kept getting misses, and I'm like, maybe this isn't it. I've personally have been told, oh, you do have abilities, you just haven't developed them yet. But a lot of that came from me being able to pick up on other people's like nonverbal cues and, you know, emotional state and everything. But I can debunk that. I studied theater, I studied acting, I studied the human condition, and I studied psychology. And this is all intertwined. So, I mean, I literally have studied how people act. So when I see certain traits in different people, based on my studies and just personal experiences, I can sync that up to, oh, well, I know they're feeling uncomfortable right now, or I know that they're feeling anxious right now. And so that's, for me, that's not really an ability. It's just me being able to like look at a conversation or read somebody's nonverbal cues and be able to pick up, like, I think they might be feeling attacked in this conversation, or or someone's feeling emotional right now. And then also with the empathy part, I go back and forth whether to say I'm empathic or not. I'm just kind of like, I don't know. Because I'm also a sensitive person. Like, if I see an elderly person eating alone in a restaurant, I start crying. So,
yeah.
Or if, like, the animal rescue commercials with Sarah McLachlan, you know, singing pop up, I start crying. So,
yeah. I like to gather all my pets in one room and just start playing in the arms of an angel. And then we all just, you know, and yeah.
Yeah, right? So if someone is feeling angry or sad or whatever in my presence, I feel it. I feel it because I can see it, and I'm just as uncomfortable. So
So I don't know.
At least for me, I feel like I'm the exception to all of these things, because they're like, oh, you can develop it if you try. And I tried. I'm like,
You know, I understand exactly what you're saying, because I feel very similar in many ways to that, where I don't consider myself an empath in the sense of that I'm picking up on someone else's feelings just because they're having them. I feel like I'm picking up on them because of the cues that they're giving, because I'm able to read their verbal cues or their physical cues or all of those cues that are given out. And I don't consider that any sort of psychic or special ability. It's more so being just tuned into those around me. And sometimes I think maybe I'm just more in tune with people like that. If they were in the other room and I never spoke to them, I'd probably have no idea what they were feeling, because I'd have no cues to go off of. But it's an interesting line, because some will say, well, you know, you wouldn't be able to pick up on all that if you weren't empathic in some way, shape, or form. I don't know. I think sometimes it's just a lot about reading the environment, and people are part of that environment. And then just kind of taking the cues from that. So now I get what you're saying. And that's, I haven't had anyone else on the show who's expressed it quite like that I completely agree with. but I do believe there are people that can feel those things without picking up on the cues. The human doesn't even have to be in the room, where the spirit doesn't, or you can't even see it, but they're picking up on those things. So when you go into an investigation, let's say it's not like an open location that, you know, is haunted and book a time now and, you know, everybody goes in. More so it's, you know, Jack and Jill's house and they don't want you talking about it. It's a private investigation. What is your goal when you get a call like that, or someone reaches out and says, could you help us? We don't know what's going on here. It's kind of freaking us out. We don't know if it's good. We don't know if it's bad, but we know there's just something kind of off. How do you go into a situation like that, you and your team?
Oh, yeah. So my team, we actually specialize in residential cases, and we are a solutions-based team. So we will try to find a resolution for what's going on. It may not be through us, but we will try to find you some help. or find a way to resolve what's going on. So we actually have a very detailed process. First, somebody has to fill out a request form. And we do ask some really detailed and personal questions. We'll ask, you know, is there any history of drugs, any history of abuse, any history of mental illness, things like that, what medications the person is currently taking, because all of that matters when you're going into a place. And also it gives us an idea of, is this a case where we can actually help you and not a situation where if we get involved, are we going to make it worse, mm-hmm. type of thing. Usually that's more involved with people who have a mental illness and they want to try to blame it on the paranormal and try to justify not taking their meds anymore, which has actually happened to us. Mm-hmm. That was not fun. Yeah. So I just try to be very careful when it comes to liability, because it is a thing. There is an issue with, you know, liability and making sure that everybody involved is safe. And then after you fill out that form, then my case manager gives you a call. And my case manager is a licensed social worker. So she has a background in mental health and psychology. And she's able to really assess, like, yeah, I think we can take this case, or I think this is more, we should just send them some tips and advice and then just wait and see what happens. Let's see. Yeah, so that's really our process. So there's a couple of steps before we actually get in and do an investigation. And we also ask, are you open to having your situation being debunked? Mm-hmm. And if they say no, we do not take it, because otherwise it's a waste of time.
Yeah. Otherwise, you're walking into a situation where people already have the answer in their mind. Why are you there? Yep. Because, I mean, the hope you would, I would think, or that they would have, would be to have it debunked. And mm-hmm. if it can't be, well, then that's something more interesting to investigate. But step number one, is this something logical that's going on? That wraps up the first part of our conversation with Alex. In part two, what are some of the cases that Alex has been involved with that she thought were highly likely an active haunting but turned out to be very explainable? What were some of the cases that had no explanations other than the supernatural? Can we ever will a haunting to happen because we want it so bad? What happened in a military housing duplex where two separate families were experiencing the same spirit on separate sides of their walls? And how often does Alex think undiagnosed mental illness is to blame for a haunting versus it being a ghost? And how often does she think that sometimes someone with mental illness is being plagued by the paranormal? All of that and more in part two of our conversation with Alex Matsuo. To hear it, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our program. Sign up to be one at thegravetalks.com. Just click become a Gravekeeper, or directly through patreon.com/thegravetalks. You'll get access to part one and part two of this interview and hundreds of our interviews, every single one we've ever created. Hours and hours, days and days, weeks and weeks, months and months of content for you to binge away on. All at your disposal. It's only $5 a month. Sign up at patreon.com/thegravetalks. You also get advanced episodes of our program months before they're released to the public, our full archive, and it's all ad-free. Check it out, patreon.com/thegravetalks. We thank you in advance for your support. To learn more about Alex's work, check out her website, thespookystuff.com. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.